Across the Pacifica network and over 50 community stations, this is Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, July 23, 2003. I am Ian Forrest. A day after U.S. forces report Saddam Hussein's two sons, Uday and Kuzey, killed, we go to Baghdad. Today in Los Angeles, closing arguments were heard in the case of a police officer charged in the year-old beating of a black youth. And the Bush administration has another explanation for the Niger uranium statement as an aide to the National Security Advisor takes the blame for not passing the faulty information up the line. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Nell Abram with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News.
New York City Councilman James Davis died today after a gunman opened fire inside New York City's council chambers. Davis, a former police officer, is also the founder of an organization aimed at stopping urban violence. Davis, who is black, joined the police department in 1983 after allegedly being beaten by two white officers. Witnesses say the gunman today was among about 100 people on a balcony inside the council chambers as the city council began a meeting. The victims, including Davis, were also on the balcony at the time. The identity of the second victim has not been released.
The U.S. House of Representatives today voted to block the FCC's new rules expanding the limits on media ownership. James Cullum reports from Washington, D.C.
Supporters and critics say that the measure to halt the deregulation of media cross-ownership rules had broad bipartisan support in Congress and passed this afternoon, but many key Republicans are raising signatures to uphold what could be President Bush's first veto in office. The FCC's June 2nd ruling allowed for media moguls like Fox News owner Rupert Murdoch to increase his influence by purchasing a number of newspaper and broadcast stations and communities where his presence is already felt. Robert McChesney, founder and president of Free Press, doesn't believe that a presidential veto is in President Bush's interests.
I think the chances that President Bush would veto an appropriations bill of $40 billion that's going to have the budgets in it for the Commerce Department, for the Justice Department, for the State Department, close those branches down to put in place these FCC regulations that are incredibly unpopular with the vast majority of Americans, I just don't buy it.
As we go to press, lawmakers have still not acted on another amendment on the same bill that would prevent the federal government from prohibiting the use of medical marijuana in the 10 states that now allow it. It would take 145 members of Congress, roughly one-third of the House of Representatives, to uphold a presidential veto. For Free Speech Radio News in Washington, D.C., I'm James Cullum.
In an overwhelming vote, the U.S. House of Representatives rolled back a key provision of the USA Patriot Act. Jennifer Cruden is in Washington.
A key part of the eliminated legislation, sneak and peek searches, did not require the owner to be notified until weeks or months after a search had been performed. The authority in such cases extended not only to suspected cases of domestic terrorism, but extended to any federal crime, including misdemeanors. The vote, as part of a measure in an appropriations bill, blocks the U.S. State Department from using any funds to perform secret searches. However, Jeffrey Fogel, legal director at the Center for Constitutional Rights, argues that the fight against this violation of the Constitution and the Fourth Amendment may not be over.
If the Justice Department hasn't been willing to follow the Constitution, which it hasn't been, there's some reason to believe, particularly when they can keep information secret, that they might not be willing to follow the law.
The Patriot Act was passed with little opposition just 6 weeks after the 9/11 attacks as a measure to address the threat of domestic terrorism. For Free Speech Radio News in Washington, D.C., I'm Jennifer Kreidenier.
The Massachusetts Attorney General issued a report today saying that during six decades, likely more than 1,000 people were molested by Roman Catholic priests and church workers, while leaders in the Boston Archdiocese engaged in a massive, inexcusable failure to do anything about it. Attorney General Tom Riley said, quote, "The magnitude of the Archdiocese's history of clergy sexual abuse of children is staggering." He called the mistreatment of children so massive and so prolonged that it borders on the unbelievable. The report outlines the results of a lengthy criminal investigation. The Archdiocese is facing more than 500 civil suits from alleged victims of clergy sex abuse. Church officials have repeatedly said they remain committed to working toward an out-of-court settlement. A U.S. district judge dismissed the two main terror counts against civil rights lawyer Lynn Stewart and her co-defendants, saying charges they conspired to support a terrorism organization were unconstitutionally vague. Simba Rousseau files this report from New York.
Civil rights attorney Lynn Stewart, her translator, and two others were charged last year with helping deliver messages from her client Sheikh Omar Abdel Rahman. Rahman, a blind Egyptian religious leader, is serving a life sentence for conspiring to blow up New York City landmarks and assassinate Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak. U.S. Attorney John Ashcroft and federal prosecutors claim Stewart, along with four others, helped deliver messages for her client to his followers in Egypt. But on Tuesday, the two counts of terrorism were dismissed. However, the U.S. District Judge left intact charges of conspiring to defraud the United States and that Stewart had made false statements. Attorney Lynn Stewart.
Any conviction would take my license away, remove me from being the defender. And so we still have a big fight on our hands, and we're going forward with that fight. Even with these terror charges out of the picture, we all know that they can get you on a technicality, and we're going to fight that as hard as we can.
In New York, I'm Simba Rousseau for Free Speech Radio News.
The Costa Rican-based United Nations project, the University for Peace, increased its hostility this week towards broadcaster Radio for Peace International. Pauline Bartolone reports from Costa Rica.
The University for Peace delivered an eviction notice to neighboring Radio for Peace International, based in El Rodeo, Costa Rica. The radio station's access gate was locked with chains and patrolled by armed guards employed by the University for Peace. The eviction notice said that the radio station must leave its facility on the university campus within 2 weeks. According to James Latham, director of Radio for Peace,
I think it is an act of censorship. There has not been any clear, defined reason why this is being done. I think what is most shocking about this action is that it's coming from an international organization that is dedicated to peace. And at this particular moment in history, all peace and social justice organizations need to be in working together in solidarity.
Radio for Peace International has been broadcasting on shortwave radio since 1987 and is the only shortwave station dedicated to human rights and social justice. From the studios of Radio for Peace International, I'm Pauline Bartolone reporting for Free Speech Radio News.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Nell Abram.
The Bush administration has another explanation for why it used bad intelligence to justify the Iraq invasion. Following the CIA's previous acceptance of blame, and after the White House had claimed ignorance, a little-known aide to National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice now contends he did know the Niger uranium story was dubious, but that he forgot to pass the information up the chain. From the Capitol, Josh Chaffin reports on the congressional reaction to the latest explanation coming out of the White House.
Hadley? Hardly. Hadley? Hardly.
Ohio Democratic Congressman and presidential candidate Dennis Kucinich refers to the up-to-now little-known White House national security aide Stephen Hadley. After weeks of controversy over the bogus story of Iraq seeking uranium from Niger, Hadley has now come out claiming he's the one to blame for letting the story get into the State of the Union speech. Congressman Kucinich.
So the American people are being asked to believe that the president, the vice president, the secretary of defense, and the national security advisor were all blissfully unaware of the fact that false nuclear claims they were circulating about Iraq were simply the result of a memo misfiled by national security clerk named Hadley.
The White House admitted yesterday that the CIA had warned them in writing on two occasions not to use the Niger story. This after the White House appeared to endorse the explanation of CIA Director George Tenet when he took the blame this month. Republicans are hoping to get the issue behind them. Asked about the Niger uranium story today, Senator Chuck Grassley walked away, telling Free Speech Radio News, quote, "That's old stuff." 2 weeks ago, Republican Senate Intelligence Committee Chair Pat Roberts, who's in charge of the investigation into the pre-war Iraqi intelligence, assured this reporter that the buck stopped with the Intelligence Committee, that George W. Bush had been ill-served by the CIA. But this morning on C-SPAN TV, Senator Roberts said that the latest White House explanation, which lays the blame on National Security aide Stephen Hadley, is the correct one.
We have made an inquiry with the National Security Council, with Ms. Rice, and asked to meet with Mr. Hadley and any other person that might be of particular interest to us. And so we will, you know, we will be in the business of taking a hard look at that.
When the Niger story first broke in the mainstream media this summer, National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice said that no one in her office had any knowledge that the Niger story might be false. Now that one of her own aides is taking the blame for letting the story get into the State of the Union speech, she's taking it back. Again, Republican Senate Intelligence Committee Chair Pat Roberts.
You know, she indicated that that was a mistake and that these memos did exist, and, you know, quite frankly, they were overlooked.
Roberts is resisting calls for a public bipartisan investigation. The anti-war, anti-Bush group MoveOn.org claims that its members have sent some 400,000 letters to congresspeople asking for the establishment of an independent commission. A bill by California House Democrat Henry Waxman would do just that. MoveOn is launching a media campaign in presidential battleground states.
Now there's evidence we were misled, and almost every day, Americans are dying in Iraq. We need the truth, not a cover-up.
In response to a similar ad paid for by Democrats, Republican forces have threatened to sue local TV stations who run it. The Republicans complain the ad omits the part of the State of the Union speech where Bush says the Africa uranium intelligence had come from a British source. Democrat Senators Carl Levin and Ted Kennedy this afternoon pointed out that Bush had made a similar claim of Iraq seeking uranium in a report to Congress before the State of the Union address, and that in that case, the claim was not attributed to the British. Tomorrow looks likely to be another day of tough questions for the administration when the Commission on the Intelligence Failures of 9/11 releases a 900-page report. Josh Chaffin at the Capitol for Free Speech Radio News.
Another ambush in Iraq today has left two more American soldiers dead, bringing the toll to 41 since President Bush's May 1 announcement of the end of combat. This a day after U.S. officials claimed attacks on occupying forces would lessen with the killing of Saddam's two sons, who were killed during a raid in the Iraqi city of Mosul. We go to John Dysart, who is a Financial Times columnist researching in Baghdad. Yesterday, it was reported that Uday and Kuzey, Saddam's sons, were successfully eliminated as targets by the U.S. occupation forces. How is the Iraqi street reacting to this?
As it happens, last night, when the news confirming their identity came out, there was a fusillade of gunfire in my neighborhood, which is actually a fairly heavily armed neighborhood, rather more heavily armed than I had thought before last night. It's a traditional way of expressing cheer at weddings. And there were a lot of very happy people. These two were extremely unpopular. They were just brutal, awful kids. And the nastiest spoiled brats in the world. And, while they had a few people mourn them, I can tell you there were hardly any around here. And the Americans were enormously pleased with themselves, of course.
How legitimate are any feelings that with the killing of these two men, among others, that the leadership of the Iraqi resistance to the U.S. occupation has been eliminated?
Oh, I don't think it has been yet. I think Saddam is still around. There's still other people fighting back. I think also when you say leadership of the Iraqi resistance, I think it's rather a little more sporadic than it's made out to be. There is a guerrilla war going on, but there's also sporadic shooting. I think that it has not been eliminated. I think that Saddam himself will have to be brought down, but it has to be a very dispiriting blow, because there will not be even in anyone's imagination now, as Saddam Hussein, a dynasty reborn. It's just over.
How do Iraqis feel about the new U.S.-appointed governing council?
Oh, I don't think they like it. I think for the most part, it's unpopular. I think that it's, they'd much rather have, I mean, odd as it sounds, I think they'd much prefer to have an American official like Paul Bremer. I think that's more acceptable in a way than a lot of them, even relatively sympathetic people, regard as a bunch of puppets, and I have to see their point. It's just kind of an insult, like they'd be, like, who are we kidding? I think that, actually, Bremer is respect somebody who, for example, admits he's wrong. That's a valued commodity around here. And the governing council also includes its heavily representative exiles who have no political base in the country. And I think that setting up a puppet council, half composed of exiles that have been in the country for a long time, a number of whom are accurately viewed as corrupt, is ridiculous. It serves the purpose of the UN, which likes the idea of a seemingly legitimate Iraqi government, which ought to give pause to people who think that the UN is the touchstone of all legitimacy. I think that it was, the Americans run the country. It is an occupation, as you say, and should be run in that way, in a straightforward way, until they leave.
You reported of shots being fired in your background.
It's a crime here. You know, this is an under-policed, to put it mildly, city with a lot of people looking to settle scores or rip other people off. And I don't think it's political. I think it's just about, a high level of crime.
That was John Dysart, a Financial Times columnist doing research in Baghdad. Meanwhile, U.S. and British attempts to secure international assistance in the rebuilding and policing of Iraq continue to be rebuffed, with France, Russia, Germany, and India all saying their troops need a new United Nations mandate. Members of the international community also want assurances their companies will have access to the Iraqi market. To allay these concerns, the U.S. recently appointed a 25-member Iraqi Governing Council. Yesterday, the body faced its first test of international legitimacy when three of its members were invited to address a public meeting of the UN Security Council. Not all went according to plan. Susan Wood reports from the UN.
The Iraqis arrived in New York, hoping to snag the UN seat left vacant in March by the departure of Saddam Hussein's ambassador. But the credibility of all three is being questioned at home and abroad. Ahmad Shalabi, head of the Pentagon-backed Iraqi National Congress, left the country in 1958 and was convicted in absentia of embezzlement in Jordan. Akila al-Hashimi, one of three women on the handpicked governing council, is tainted by her close ties to the former regime. These two kept a low profile yesterday, while former Foreign Minister Adnan Pachachi, speaking through an interpreter, equated the body with the interim administration called for in a recent Security Council resolution.
Our participation in this meeting is considered by the Iraqi people as a clear and express recognition of the sovereignty of Iraq, which you stressed in the second preambular paragraph of 1483.
Shortly before Pachachi spoke, the meeting was disrupted when anti-war activists Medea Benjamin and Gail Murphy rose to denounce the Governing Council as a creature of the U.S. They were dragged from the visitors' gallery by U.N. security guards. Benjamin, a spokesperson for the newly established International Occupation Watch Center in Baghdad, later spoke with Free Speech Radio News.
We just got back from Iraq a week ago, and people kept asking, why was it after the Gulf War, when the electrical grid was destroyed and the phone system was destroyed, 1 month later they were back up and running. Now it's been 4 months, and they still have no basic services. So people are angry, they're confused, they don't know if the U.S. is doing this on purpose or if it's just tremendous lack of planning. In any case, their lives are miserable and they're unhappy. The Governing Council was a hand-picked group selected by the U.S. occupying forces and seen by most of the Iraqis that we talked to as illegitimate, not credible. They felt that the Iraqis had no say in who was going to be picked.
Iraqi journalist Iman Ahmed Hamas is co-director of the Occupation Watch Center, which is supported by the anti-war coalition United for Peace and Justice. Speaking from Baghdad, she said the unelected governing council, whose decisions can be vetoed by the U.S., does not represent 27 million Iraqis.
Most of the members of this council are not from inside Iraq. Most of them are ex-exiles. They came on the American tanks. So many people here consider them as collaborators with the occupiers.
The man to whom these criticisms were addressed, U.S. Administrator in Iraq Paul Bremer, was reported to be meeting with officials in Washington and did not attend the Security Council debate. For their part, members of the 15-nation Security Council cautiously welcomed the establishment of the governing council as a first step toward self-rule, but made it clear Iraqis must be given more control over their political future, a point underscored by UN Secretary General Kofi Annan.
Our collective goal remains an early end to the military occupation through the formation of an internationally recognized representative government. Meanwhile, it is vital that the Iraqi people should be able to see a clear timetable with a specific sequence of events leading to the full restoration of sovereignty as soon as possible. In practical terms, this means that the establishment of the Governing Council must be followed by a constitutional process run by Iraqis for Iraqis.
While neither Annan nor any member of the Security Council endorsed the Governing Council for a UN seat, critics Medea Benjamin and Gail Murphy said the delegation's very presence undermined the credibility of the UN. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Susan Wood at the United Nations.
A little over a year ago, the graphic videotaped arrest of a black teenager, Donovan Jackson, sent shockwaves through the LA area. The trial of the police officer charged with assault is now wrapping up. In today's closing arguments, prosecutors called the officer who had beat and punched the teen out of control and angry. This case will soon be in the jury's hands. As Jordan Davis reports, though, the trial hasn't pleased many community members. They're preparing a peaceful reaction, whatever the verdict may be.
In press reports, Inglewood is often referred to generically as suburban Los Angeles. But this all-American city under the arriving jumbo jets at the LA airport is as economically diverse as the big city next door. And unlike the images many Americans have of the suburbs, it's a city whose population is split nearly 50-50 between African Americans and Latinos. So when the videotape of a handcuffed black teenager being punched and slammed across the hood of a car by a white Inglewood police officer was broadcast on TV screens across LA and across the country, outrage here was especially strong. Now, a little more than a year later, Officer Jeremy Morse is on trial for assault under the color of authority. His partner is also being tried for filing a false police report, but it's a trial that hasn't won accolades from some community leaders or civil rights attorneys who specialize in police misconduct, like Leo Terrell.
It's been a weak case, and I would be totally shocked that these officers are guilty or found guilty of any crimes.
Terrell points to testimony by an expert prosecution witness, L.A. Sheriff Commander Charles Heal. He said on the stand that the actions by Officer Morse were improper, but not necessarily criminal. Heal, along with another prosecution witness, also admitted under cross-examination that if the defense's theory that Donovan Jackson grabbed the officer's testicles is true, then the slam against the car and the following punch would have been justified. But the district attorney has bristled at charges they've been sloppy in this trial in choosing their witnesses. Spokeswoman Sandy Gibbons.
The case was presented fully in a professional manner. The truth was told. And now it's up to the jury to make a determination based on the evidence that they heard in court, not some statement that somebody who doesn't know what they're talking about makes outside of court.
But Terrell says that the way this case has been tried points to a much larger problem.
The district attorney and the police department and law enforcement are in bed together. They don't like prosecuting, quote, their friends. They work together on solving these so-called cases. But when it comes to dirty cops, the prosecution within the county of L.A. have a very difficult time singling out and pointing out bad cops.
The resemblance of this case to the Rodney King beating trial 10 years ago isn't lost on many. The two cases have hinged on a videotape of a black suspect being beaten by white officers. Then the jury was all white. Now the jury has one black panelist out of 12. But this time around, the jury's makeup has been little discussed, with critics of the trial being more likely to fault the DA's case than the racial mix of the jurors. One similarity Inglewood community leaders are hoping doesn't repeat itself, a civil uprising following an acquittal. They've been working to calm simmering anger following the graphic videotape showing on television. After angry protesters mobbed Inglewood City Hall a year ago, Khalid Shaw of the neighborhood organization Stop the Violence, Increase the Peace worked with block associations, churches, and community groups to open up a new dialogue between the community and law enforcement. Shaw told reporters yesterday he believes that by channeling the public's anger over police misconduct, he can help make progress.
We talked about some very sensitive issues. I think wherever communications is open, I think we have a chance to make progress. And we're talking. And we're talking about how can we do this, why police officers are afraid in the inner city, why people in the inner city are afraid of police officers, what can be done to train their people, what can be done to train our people. I think great progress is being made.
The day the jury's decision is announced, hundreds of volunteer peace ambassadors will go on to Inglewood streets, urging people to express their emotions in constructive ways. Community leaders say they're sure there will be peace on the streets the day of the verdict. In Los Angeles, for Free Speech Radio News, I'm Jordan Davis.
Free Speech Radio News commentator Mumia Abu-Jamal is on death row in Pennsylvania. From his cell, he observes world events.
The Bush-Blair Doctrine. The Iraq War is over, or is it? With a spate of attacks that have cost American lives almost daily, the newly minted general in charge of the region, Abu Zaid, has been forced to admit the obvious. Iraqis are waging a guerrilla war against the British and American foreigners who came to bring freedom and democracy. Meanwhile, the Bush-Blair axis is frayed at the seams with the White House's recent admission that Bush should not have given the old Niger gave Saddam uranium ploy, as it was being easily demolished in Europe already. The great Iraq victory over the forces of tyranny is fast becoming a great big mess. Iraqis, like most folks, don't like being told what to do by outsiders. They may not have loved their wily president, Hussein, but he's beginning to look a little lovely besides the specter of British and Americans riding roughshod over their country, telling them what they can do, what they can't do, telling them what they can say and what they can't say. Several days ago, a young man on death row made an interesting remark when a bunch of men were discussing the latest events coming out of Iraq. He first stated, okay, now that it looks like they lied to the American people to justify going in there, shouldn't they just give dude his country back? Now, when several men laughed at his remark, he added seriously, look, they used bogus reasons to go in there. They took over them people's country. Seriously, now, that ain't right. Can't they just give it back to those people? Some of us laughed. Others simply pondered it, as if the thought never occurred to us before. The Americans didn't drop mass tonnage of bombs over Baghdad to bring democracy to the Iraqis. Britons didn't strike Najaf to introduce the Iraqis to parliamentary democracy. The Bush and Blair war plans didn't seek to liberate the Iraqi people. They can certainly find millions of people in the world who are not liberated. Britain can look no further than its perpetual colony of some 700 years, Ireland. The U.S. can look to its Caribbean colony, the so-called Commonwealth of Puerto Rico. They went to war carrying the briefs of big business, in search not of liberty, but of the vast oil deposits that sit almost within arm's reach in the desert regions. Before the war, millions of people yelled at the top of their lungs, "No blood for oil." They were right then. They're right now. That's the reason for the rush, the mad dash for war that couldn't wait for weapons inspectors, the UN, anybody. Now we find manufactured evidence fed to the U.S. from Britain. It was designed to push U.S. citizens to fear. And guess what? It worked. The war was easily started, but it ain't so easy to end. From death row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are produced by Noel Hanrahan for Prison Radio.
For Free Speech Radio News, I am Ian Forrest. Visit online www.fsrn.org.